Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Homo sapiens' version of humanity seems to have burst out of its prehistoric cradle of Africa much sooner and in dribbles rather than the massive surge assumed to have occurred around 100,000 years ago, and through more varied escape routes into the greater world than previously perceived, routing other versions of Homo erectus, such as Neanderthals and so-called Denisovians. Be that as it may, it is most likely that the consistent struggle of all forms of humanity has been equality between its bifurcated genders. Today, August 26th, is an historic anniversary of a significant milestone in the eternal struggle, the right of women to vote in the USA, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which became law 101 years ago today in 1920. Leonora Murray celebrated this victory in an article she wrote for the North Coast Times Eagle, its first year of its double life in 1979, the 26th of August, which I generally read on this program every year. The 26th of August by Leonora Murray. August 26th is not just another summer day. It is a day of remembrance, a special day which honors three generations of American women who successfully campaigned for 72 years and finally won a basic right of citizenship, the right to vote. One wonders how long it will take to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. Susan B. Anthony went to jail because she attempted to vote. A federal judge told her that citizen did not mean women. If we meant women, we would say woman. So who says we don't need the ERA? I think all of us on the Oregon coast have feminist ancestors who endured ridicule, derision, distortion, and verbal and physical assaults to gain equality. We all have grandmothers and mothers, aunts, sisters, wives, daughters, sweethearts, and cousins. Women who got thrown in jail for joining strikes, who got fired when asking for equal wages, who were denied access to training and education on the basis of sex, who marched and demonstrated, who still march and demonstrate. On August 26, we should remember our folk heroes, the women who attended the first Equal Rights Conference in New York and published the Seneca Falls Declaration of 1848, the women who joined the Woman's Party that Alice Paul founded, the women who were blue-collar workers and union organizers. We should remember them all with love and celebration. We should celebrate the gutsy Dr. Mary Wright, Congressional Medal of Honor winner. She was a battlefield surgeon for the Union Army in the Civil War. 50 years later, Congress decided she hadn't been brave enough and requested the medal be returned. She refused, so Congress denied her military pension. Unfortunately, no one bothered to take down her exact words, but they must have been dillies to make Congress take such strong action against her. We should celebrate Sojourner Truth. Her speech, "Ain't I a Woman," made history when she asked if women were frail and weak, how come nobody kept her from working as a field hand? And if motherhood and women's sensitivity precluded them from public life, then where were those who worried about her sensitivity when her five children were sold into slavery? In one instance, she faced down a Bible-quoting mob saying that she did indeed believe in Jesus, but that the men in the mob had nothing to do with Jesus. That was between God and women. No men anywhere. A very nice lady. A very tough lady. And we should not forget Sacagawea, pathfinder for the Messrs. Lewis and Clark, or Luke Stone, who made up her own wedding vows and kept her own name, or Jane Addams, not only a great humanitarian, but the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, or Abigail Adams, who insisted to her husband, the great revolutionary and signer of the Declaration of Independence, that more than just men were created equal, or Amelia Bloomer, who tried so hard to make sense out of fashion, or Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who spent her life struggling for the rights of women. And most of all, we should celebrate the grand old lady, Susan B. Anthony, who said, "Failure is impossible. We must believe it, even if it takes another 72 years to get women written into the National Constitution and consciousness." She did not forget the men either. On men's liberation, she said, "Of course, for are not all men the children of women?" And most heartening and solemn of all, Susan B. Anthony said, "Until women have the same rights as men on this green earth, there shall never be another season of silence." We should all support our local daycare centers. We should join the local chapter of the National Organization of Women now, or start one. We should support our women's crisis centers. And best of all, we should celebrate our gallant women. And that was by Leonora Murray. And she originally wrote this article for the Times-Eagle in 1979. The 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which was ratified on August 18, 1920, and became law on August 26 that year, declares, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." And now, something I wrote, also for the Times-Eagle, Equal Rights Amendment. And the amendment itself, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex," quote, unquote. This shameful pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took more than a century after the inception of the United States for American women to gain the vote. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution will not stay dead. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982, the date the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men, quote unquote, in 1776. The ERA failed even though it had the support of 80% of the electorate because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states that had initially approved the measure rescinded their votes, despite latterly second thoughts of at least one of them. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The ERA has been sent to the grave more than once in the 98 years since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, and the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 53 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within months. Instead, when revived again, and it will be, a newly re-elected Congress should resurrect the ERA as one of its first measures. It must once again travel the torturous long trail through the states. 38 states must ratify it, and even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One prime possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA an essential part of the Constitution is for women to vote out of office all who oppose it and support only candidates who endorse it, which was not an issue in this past election, but might very well be a crucial affirmation of gender equality in the next. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, there shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth. And that was something I wrote, B-E-R-A. And now, by Tamim Ansari. History shows us that outsiders can never bring peace to Afghanistan. Friends keep asking me to sign petitions urging President Biden to change his mind about withdrawing troops from Afghanistan. They all agree that the U.S. can't stay in the country forever, but this, they say, is not the time to leave. The Taliban are surging, and the social gains of the past 20 years are in jeopardy. I have not signed any of those petitions. Yes, the Taliban have committed horrific offenses, and they won't stop. And they must be stopped. Just the other day, I saw a video of villagers in northern Afghanistan burying a dozen civilians killed by a bomb. An old woman wept because her whole family had been wiped out. Oh, but wait. That bomb was dropped by the government, delivered by drone. Both sides in this war kill civilians. I would sign any petition that would stop the fighting and bring peace. What's more, when this war ends, I hope the government now in Kabul emerges victorious. I hope Afghans resume their social and material progress on every front. But I can't forget a pattern of Afghan history so blatant that I'm amazed it's not central to this conversation. The government in Kabul has never been able to secure authority in Afghanistan as a whole when it is held in place by an outside power's military. In 1839, the British replaced the Afghan monarch, Dost Mohammad, with his rival, Shah Shuja, who had just as legitimate a claim to the throne as he. But the British had put him in power, so the country went up in flames, and 2 years later the whole British community in Kabul had to flee on foot, most of them dying on the way out. In 1878, the British tried again. This time they ousted Afghan ruler Sher Ali and tried to rule the country through his son, Yaqub. Sure enough, the British cantonment was sacked, their representative was killed. The country went up in flames. The British had to give up and leave the country to a strong man, Abdul Rahman, who knew what he needed to do to secure his position with Afghans. He made a deal with the British and Russia to keep them both out of Afghanistan. Jump ahead to 1978. The Soviets helped Afghan communists topple the last of the Afghan ruling family and elevated their own man, Nur Muhammad Taraki, to power. What happened? The country went up in flames. The Soviets sent in 100,000 troops to keep the communists in power, but that only turned the fire into a bonfire. The war raged for 10 years until at last the Soviets simply left, with the country eviscerated. Then came the Americans. They dropped a fully formed government on Kabul, picked Hamid Karzai to run the country, and clothed him in all the markers of legitimacy recognized in Western democracies, constitution, parliament, elections. Under Karzai, girls went back to school, women's rights improved, infrastructure was restored, progress was made. Sure enough, however, as with all the previous great power attempts to manage Afghans through Afghan proxies, Kabul proved unable to secure countrywide legitimacy. Resistance brewed in the villages and spread to the cities. In its war with forces based in the countryside, the Kabul government was hobbled by one huge disadvantage: the outside military forces that were helping it hold power. Because of that, it had no narrative to counter the one the Taliban wielded, which said the government in Kabul is not Afghan. It's a bunch of puppets and proxies for Americans and Europeans, whose main agenda is to undermine Islam. Drones and bombs could not defeat that narrative, but only feed it. The U.S. and NATO can't stay in Afghanistan forever, but is this the time to leave? The answer has to be yes, if as I am arguing, the U.S. and NATO military presence in Afghanistan is causing the very problem it is supposed to be solving. Many people assume the Taliban are the face of what Afghanistan would be without U.S. help, but the American military presence might be obscuring the single most crucial fact: the Taliban don't represent Afghan culture. They, too, are, in a sense, an alien force. Before the Soviet invasion 40 years ago, it is fair to say most Afghans were deeply devoted Muslims. The underlying issue among Afghans was not Islam or not Islam, but which version of Islam. Kabul's urban progressive version or the conservative version of the villages. Afghans involved in that debate were the ones who rose up against the Soviet invaders. But the Taliban are not those Afghans. The Taliban originated in the refugee camps of Pakistan. Their worldview was molded in religious schools funded by elements of Pakistan's military intelligence agency. They were armed by Islamists from the Arab world, some of whom are in the country now, calling themselves Taliban. If the Western military presence were removed, the Afghan energy that refuses to accept outsiders telling them who to be might recognize the Taliban as the alien force. The great irony of the Western project to bring democracy and social progress to Afghanistan is this: Afghans have a powerful progressive current of their own. It is Islamic, not secular, but it is progressive. In the 6 decades after the country gained independence from the British and before it was invaded by the Soviets, Afghanistan was governed by Afghans. During that time, what did that Afghan government achieve? It liberated Afghan women from the previously obligatory burqa. It promulgated a constitution. It created a parliament with real legislative power. It set up elections. It built schools for girls nationwide. It pushed for co-education. It opened women's access to a college education at Kabul University, and it opened public employment opportunities for them in professions such as medicine and law. It is staggering to look back at that era. As the U.S. and British withdrawal proceeds, the country is surrounded by outside forces, hungering to get in. Pakistan, Iran, Russia, India, China. Before any of them succeed, there ought to be a global conference at which international actors can work out a way to keep one another out of Afghanistan. For what Afghans really need help with is getting everyone else to leave them alone. And that was by Tami Ansari, who was born in Kabul, Afghanistan. He is the author of Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. He has written for Pacific News Service and once was a writer for the famous now defunct Portland Scribe in Portland, Oregon. He wrote, "History shows us that outsiders can never bring peace to Afghanistan," for the Guardian newspaper. And now, a poem by Carolyn Dunn. Medical Bunker, Karangal Valley. Two guys dug out bunker, Afghanistan. Always night, isn't it, with those beautiful mountains under the moon. Bunker a hole in the ground, dry rock hell to dig. Bandages, half canteen of water, no morphine, out of alcohol, no antibiotic. Wind, at night too cold, dirt floor. Did you hear something? Light bulb moved? Someone out there? Just swab my leg, whatever you got infection in there. Okay, done. Sit back in this sandbagged grave. Bulb jingles again, trickle of dust, lean down. Oh, valley of my hands, whole face, mouth, nose, eyes, ears, infinitesimal avalanche of dust. And another poem by Carolyn Dunn. War maimed. Three children at a zoo. Two have taught scarred faces, badly burned. Two have stumps for arms. One has burns and stumps. Their face are immobile. Their abbreviated arms hang at their sides or aim toward a wall for balance. Multiple surgeries, hour upon hour of physical therapy. No expression, not even the armless child with soft skin on her face. And now, a final poem from Carolyn Dunn. More all. They found, 200 miles from shore, an ancient Greek cargo ship at the bottom of the sea. Ports from Georgia to Oregon want deeper rivers, dredge for ever bigger ships. More amphorae of wine, more cars, more bolts of cloth, more plastic, gas, zinc, fuzzy toys, strawberries, hardware parts, shoes, more, more. We still go down on our seas. We still don't know whether it is collision, bad weather, poor shipbuilding, or careless decisions. There are not channels deep enough to hold our ignorance. But more always wins the day. All we want is all there is, exactly as we wanted it then. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser-Schalk is engineer for this program. Keith Jarrett provided intro piano. A memory of many moons ago that occurred in the old and extinct Seasider Motel Lounge in Seaside back in the previous millennium, 1977, I think. And I wrote this. Dancing was a woman in a wheelchair. She had no legs, yet she moved the wheelchair as if it were organic to her. The chair moved like her hips, and its wheels were as good as her legs. A man danced with her beautifully. On the slow dances, he bent over and moved the chair as perfectly as Fred Astaire with Ginger Rogers. She whirled and swung around, using the momentum of his outstretched arms to wheel her about the dance floor, into him and out again, and around again, just a little bit more, just so. Saucy, her half-filled catheter bag swung beneath her chair like a tail. And now, from Helen McInnes, which she wrote in 1952. It was a journey in emotion as much a journey through unknown places. At first, she welcomed it as a chance to be anonymous, to feel secure from telephones and newspapers and talk, a complete break. She was shut inside a speeding train with strange faces, strange voices around her. Outside, the shape of the land was different. The trees and fields and rivers were different. The houses were different. Even the people seemed different in their way of dressing, in their expression and voice. Surface differences, perhaps, but powerful enough based on the way they lived, on the sky above them that brought rain or drought, deep snow or mild winters, on the shape of the land itself, on its wealth or its poverty. And as she looked at a farm lying too near a swollen river, at a holding where the earth was cracked with erosion, at a town whose growth had trickled into sleep, at a city that had drawn too many people into its reach, she saw that all this strangeness was only a difference in problems, the problems that each person had to face every day of life. Wherever anyone traveled, there was no escape from them. And she looked at the prosperous places, at the hundreds of miles of rich plowed fields, at the freshly painted houses and repaired barns and gleaming silos, at the stretches of smooth roads and wooded hillsides, at the massed factories, large as palaces and as imposing, at the huge encampment of automobiles waiting to take the workers to their outflung colonies of new houses sheltering under a forest of television trees. And as she looked at all that, she saw the perpetual problems. They were the one constant in all these miles of difference. The problems were always there. First, what shall I live on? And where shall I live? To solve, what shall I live on? And how shall I live? To solve, where shall I live? Some people stopped there. It used up a lot of energy and determination even to reach that point. But their problems were solved if they worked hard enough at them. If they faced the challenge, that in itself was a victory. And others went on from there. Now their problems started with why. Why should I do this? Why ought I? Why must I? These weren't so easily solved. The challenge had become more difficult to answer. And could a person ever hope to answer it if never having faced the first challenge, the questions that began with what and where and how? And that was by Helen McGinnis. She wrote this about a train trip across the USA in 1952. The plague on all our houses, vaxxed and unvaxxed, is not yet about to abate. Pointing fingers is not useful. Seeking reason rather than fiction is necessary to defeat this baneful scourge of humanity, at least until the next scourge. And thanks, and a tip of the hat for all the 80th birthday greetings.